And in closing, my name's Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
everybody. Appreciate very much being here. I need to really get these things said because I may get wound up and forget it. I want to thank Mike and whoever was responsible for getting me here. I want to thank Nob and Linda for taking care of me and giving me a place to stay. Really is good to see Reggie and to see Scott and to see Peggy. Dick isn't here, and I was looking forward to seeing him, but he's got to be away. And that really means a lot to me. Of course, this community has long had the reputation around the country as being a hotbed of enthusiasm, and it really is. I got the wrong damn shirt, and I swear I've gained about 10 pounds, and my shirts don't fit anymore. And I told myself I wasn't going to do this, but if I don't, I'm going to faint. So that's all that's coming off. I don't care what anybody else. I'm maybe easy, but I do have my principles, you know. But y'all have been known for that for a long time, and it's very obvious when I get here. And it's also kind of interesting, as I've traveled the country, and Peggy can understand what I'm saying, and maybe some other people who've had the privilege and honor to be able to travel the country and talk, is anytime you got something really good going for you, everybody shoots at you. You know, if you don't want to get out on the point in this program, or if you don't want to get something thrown at you, then don't get out on the point in this program, because this is a wonderful program composed of some of the sickest and healthiest people on earth. And that's just the way that it is. I mean, dear God, he wouldn't have put us together if he didn't know that we needed to be together. And I've always been intrigued as I've traveled this country by the almost 180-degree polarization of people's reaction who have been Most of the people who've been here don't have anything but a positive reaction. The ones who have anything bad to say about y'all have never been here in your brand of AA, which I'm sitting here thinking, my God, isn't this wonderful? They're singing Christmas carols, they're showing crafts, they're loving each other, they're hugging each other, they're eating together. What is their kind of AA, you know? Where the hell did that come from, right? And you know what I'm talking about. I mean, it's that clan that exist in Nebraska, you know? I would to God that more people had that plan. I really did enjoy the Christmas carols, the whole spirit of it. AA, Bill Wilson said that AA was a common property of all mankind. And essentially, AA has not got one single original thing in it. Even the concept of one drunk working with another was not original to AA. Washingtonians did it in the middle 1800s. Of course, they forgot a lot of the other stuff that Wilson learned from it. We learned from it and have used many of those principles that the Washingtonians failed over. Said the common property of all mankind. While we did not originate the idea of one human being serving another, we have perfected it. And I'm just grateful to kick off this season of giving and sharing and loving each other. I can't think of another place I'd rather be than in AA, and quite honestly, I can't think of another place I'd rather be right now than with y'all. And there's another reason for that. Some of y'all don't know this, but my daughter, who's been in AA, she's been 14 or 15 years? 15 years, is with y'all. And my son-in-law, Libby and Michael, came out here to live, 1 year, 2 years? 2 years ago. Michael's really not a ventriloquist. I am talking. I just don't know why we're doing that. And they together, or separately, or I don't know how it works, What are you laughing at, Reggie? You just found out a couple of years ago what this old deal was. He shared with me one time, and I promised him I wouldn't embarrass him, but I just can't help it. He just leaves it. They had my first granddaughter, my only grandchild, Lee. And Lee is now, again, Michael, 4 months. Good, 4 months old. And it's just wonderful. Libby's got her in the back room there so that she doesn't get overcome with joy at her grandfather giving an AA talk. I tell you what, though, when I really did this, I looked at that baby the first time I saw her when I flew out here, and she's just beautiful and she's wonderful, and I'm looking at this beautiful child. And you know, most grandparents will look at their grandchildren and they'll think of Harvard and Yale and MIT, and I'm sitting here thinking of Betty Ford and. You know, and what's your home group, you know? I mean, this child is, I mean, you talk about high-risk people.
Yeah.
If she was equally at risk of hitting by a truck, no one would ever let her cross the street because she'd never make it. And you just know that that's the way it is. But the thing about it is, in this child, see, I'm able to span six generations in my memory. I've seen six generations in my family. I remember my great-grandmother. And now this grandchild. And this child is the first child in this family that will have an opportunity to live in both an alcohol and drug-free home and one that is sane in the recovery from alcoholism. And that is just a joy to me because God gave me the privilege of being the Brady who broke the circle. And if there's any reason to be grateful, I can't think of another reason to be more grateful than that. That I was given that opportunity and so far have taken that responsibility and run with it. And many of y'all are the same. And for those of you who are, I commend you. And weren't we privileged and aren't we privileged, you know? I need to clarify a couple of things before I get started. First of all, I don't mean to preach or teach. The fact is I'll do a little bit of both. It's never intended to be that way. It just always comes out that way, you know? But that's okay, because if there hadn't been preachers and teachers in my life, I'd be dead. And I'm so grateful that some of those great icons, and not that I consider myself one, but I've been sober, as of 2 days ago, been sober 20 years. December the 1st, 1977. You know, as the old saying goes, I'm now considered an old-timer because I've got 20 years. What does it take to be an old-timer is don't drink and don't die. You know, that's an old AA saying. Well, I finally made it to be an old-timer. And those of us who have reached this point in time begin to feel strongly the sense of responsibility to be able to say some things and share some things that little pitcher with big ears has out there listening. This talk is obviously for the newcomer. It's obviously for me. But it's for that individual 1 year of sobriety who doesn't really know how to say, I still don't have a clue, you know, and feel like that they need to act like they got a clue, but they don't know how to say, I don't have a clue. Well, it's for that person. Or the one with 2 years of sobriety who all of a sudden now has decided not only have they got a clue, they got the whole damn book and the answer to everything. You know? I mean, that's... And then the person with 5 years of sobriety who all of a sudden realizes they are completely lost. Yeah. I mean, they can't find the parking lot, you know? Or the one with 10 years of sobriety who thinks that the real way to get to heaven is to have 700 pigeons stretching all over everywhere and the Ohio River and both sides, you know, in Indiana. And then the person with 20 years of sobriety who decides that AA is not what it was supposed to be, so they're going to go into clandestine secret meetings because AA is screwed up, you know? Or the person with 30 years of sobriety who doesn't need a sponsor. Or the person with 42 years of sobriety who decided because his wife had died and he'd met this new young woman and she liked to have wine before dinner, that he'd rather have a glass of wine than run the risk of being alone again. This talk's for every one of those people because I've made 12-step calls on every one of those people. I put in the hospital last week a woman who got drunk after 25 years, and she spent the last 6 years trying to get another year of sobriety. And for the last year, she's been secretly drinking, lost 45 pounds, and was one of my great role models when I came in AA, which tells me the simple truth that all of us who've been around know, and those of you who haven't been around long enough, you need to hear it, is nobody ever graduates. Not if you're an alcoholic of my type. which is what you got to decide. If you're an alcoholic of my type, and if you are, we don't graduate. But we sure as hell get deluded. You know? We sure as hell get deluded on some incredibly simple issues. Had a guy one time say that he never had seen anybody get drunk falling over rocks, but they seemed to get drunk tripping over pebbles. You know? And pretty soon they fell enough times that it just seemed like it was a good reason to lay down. Those are the kind of things that I want to address tonight and the people I want to talk with, and I need to hear it. I need to hear it. I came into, and the program, at least my program of recovery, the one thing that doesn't change about, at least in my experience, it doesn't change about AA is it's always changing. It is always changing. And what I will talk about tonight is where I am today. It wasn't where I was a year ago or 2 years ago. And I don't expect it'll be where I will be 5, 10, or 15 years from now. The mosaic of my absolute drunkalogue and whatnot doesn't really change. My insights into recovery have changed considerably and continue to change. So what I'm going to talk about tonight is just where I am today. For some of you, you'll think, my God, I'm glad God sent him to me. I've been waiting to hear this guy forever. For some of you, you'll think, that's nice. Nice way to spend the evening. I saw a lot of my friends. And for some of you, you'll go home and think, what the hell is that all about? You know? But that's just the way it is. That's just the way it is. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1977 in Louisville, Kentucky, in a time when I call it the best and worst of times in AA in Louisville. It was the best of times because there was an incredible fellowship, this same kind of spirit. And when I came in, there were about seven or eight of us guys who just locked at the hip. And our wives came with us, and we were inseparable. We went everywhere together. It was almost like we went to the bathroom together. I called it the little pygmy syndrome. You know, we had a hold of each other's tails, walking like this. One peed, we all peed. One sit down, we all sit down. That's just the way it was. We played golf together. I mean, that was it. And our wives were right there. We went to meetings together almost every night. We went out to breakfast on weekends. We played golf. It was just an incredible fellowship. And I got to tell you, I'm really grateful that it happened because it was one of those ingredients that would keep me sober at a time when I really didn't have the tools and didn't know to have the tools not to keep from drinking. But that fellowship was beautiful. And one of the things that out here, y'all have captured this and maintained it. But around the country, and certainly in Louisville at times, I see this thing is switched to where there's a lot of adherence to get there 30 minutes early, stay 30 minutes late, and set up the ashtray and set up the coffee. But it's not stay with each other damn near 24 hours a day. And it was a wonderful time in Alcoholics Anonymous in Louisville with the fellowship. It was the worst of times in AA because we never even talked about the big book. The marching orders in Louisville at that time was don't drink, get a sponsor, tell him everything that's wrong with you, he'll tell you what to do, and then go save a drunk. Those were the marching orders. I mean, I became a lethal weapon for God. I was everywhere in that community. I mean, the deal was, here he comes, drink a beer. He's going to take you to treatment anyway. Hell, you might as well have the beer. I'm prone to exaggerate, but I'm not really exaggerating. That's the way it was. That's exactly the way it was. My first fourth step was in a treatment center. And I need to tell anyone who's just come out of a treatment center or who may still be hanging on to the illusion that was a fourth step, that unless it was a unique treatment center, and some of them are, unless it was a unique treatment center, you did a family history. You did a personal story. But you didn't do a fourth step. Not the way it was devised by Alcoholics Anonymous. My second fourth step was a 300-question questionnaire that my sponsor got from Hazleton and gave it to me. I was 2 years sober. My third fourth step, I was 4 years sober, and it was a 250-question questionnaire that my sponsor made up for me to take. And those were my first three fourth steps. I literally lived in that first 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous on a 3 1/3-step program. The first three steps and a third of the 12th step, which was save a drunk. That was it. I had no problem being powerless over alcohol, but drinking a quart of whiskey a night when I begged and was sent to treatment, And I was powerless not only because I could stop drinking, I was powerless because I couldn't get it to work. I couldn't drink enough whiskey to get drunk. I could drink enough to quit having diarrhea, and I could drink enough to settle down my stomach, and I could drink enough to stop sweating, but I couldn't drink enough to get drunk and stop it. It didn't work anymore. So when I stay sober today under pressure and somebody says, do you think about taking a drink? No. Why in the hell would I think about taking a drink? It didn't work. No matter how hard I stretch it, it didn't work. It didn't work. And my life was unmanageable. When I'm sitting in a treatment center and I open the closet and my roommate's hanging in the closet, your life gets pretty unmanageable, you know? And I remember sitting on the foot of the bed looking at this guy hanging in the closet thinking, who am I going to get to play ping pong with? You know, now, even in that altered state that I was in, I thought, that's inappropriate. I'm serious. So, I mean, I could give you the whole litany of my life being unmanageable, but that just gives you a classic example of how way out of line it had become. You know? Yeah, and I knew it'd take a power greater than me to restore me to sanity, because if there wasn't such a power, I was screwed. I mean, that was it, because I had done everything I knew to do. I'd had 12 years of amphetamine with no alcohol, 8 years of alcohol with no amphetamine. I mean, I'd reached the point no matter what I did, I became addicted to it. I became habituated to it. It dominated my life. I have every reason to be an Alcoholics Anonymous and call myself an alcoholic, because I was drinking a quart of whiskey a night. And told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. You know, and there are people in this room saying, I understand. Yeah, me too. I understand that. You tell that to the straight people, they say, my God, he's crazy. And you're saying, okay, I got it. And so it'd take a power greater than me to restore me to sanity. The idea of turning my life, my will over to the care of God, that was not a problem in wanting to do it. It was a problem in being able to do it in what I thought was the way it was supposed to be done, because I had this misconception that almost everybody drags in here with them, that they have to define God and that I had to figure out what it meant to turn my life and my will over. Well, first of all, that gets to be real bizarre. That's what kept me really in trouble back before I did have a drinking and drugging problem. But when you first quit drinking and drugging, when you're drinking a quart of whiskey a night and you're an alcoholic of my type, is you can't figure that out under any circumstances, because it's an abstract concept. And we are not capable of thinking abstractly for almost 2 years. We got sawdust for brains. Wilson described it in 1938 when he wrote the book, his story, when he said he couldn't get a job for a year and a half because he was racked with waves of self-pity and resentment. He was describing what medical science described in 1979 as the post-acute recovery syndrome. And the post-acute recovery syndrome is characterized by the inability to have short-term memory for 6 months to 2 years. I used to lose my car drinking all the time. I lost my car sober for 2 years. I lost it one time in an 11-place parking lot. That was the parking lot where we parked our cars. Now, I'm not kidding you. You think I'm exaggerating. I'm telling you, I would drive my car to the office, get out, practice medicine, get in the car, and go home. This day, I drove Casey, my wife's car, parked it, went in, came out, didn't see my car, started crying. I cried a lot in that first year. I would cry at the sun coming up. I'd cry at the sun going down. Hell, I'd cry at the radio coming on. I'd cry at the newspaper. Hell, I'd cry at anything. So I went in and got my partner, and I said, Dave, somebody stole my car. He walked out and said, Burns, you drove Casey's car. And I said, oh, God, that's right. I forgot. So they assigned me a parking space. I mean, hell, these aren't recovering people. These are my partners. All they know is he can't find his car. Give him a spot. They don't have to figure it out. Give him a spot. Said when he leaves the office, he's going to that parking space. If he can get whatever's in it started, he's going to drive it home. Now, this is the kind of mind we had, you know? This is the kind of mind we've got when we come in here. And we think we're going to figure something out. Sleep patterns screwed up for 6 months to 2 years.
can't sleep. Hell, nobody ever died from lack of sleep. Y'all don't have any compassion, you know?
Yeah. Oh, with our newest sleeping pills, Ambien, and those kind of sleeping pills, I can see some heads going, you know, they say it's not habit forming. Hell, the only not habit forming drug is the one that came out today. If it's here, been here a week, we'll get addicted to it. I mean, this is absolutely the truth. So we had, and I used to go into the AA meeting. I came home, I went to AA, I went to church, I went to see a psychiatrist. I would have eaten a bucket of manure if it would have kept me sober. I was finished. I was one of the fortunate ones. I was finished. And the psychiatrist, this was in early 78, so he didn't know about this post-acute recovery syndrome. So he said, Burns, I want you to come see me on Monday. I want you to come Tuesday. I want you to see me on Thursday. So I'd go in on Tuesdays, and I'd work, and I'd come back on Thursday, and I'd say, where do you want me to start, Homer? And he'd say, go back to where we were on Tuesday. And I'd say, I can't remember where we were. And he said, you're blocking your therapy. And I'd go, oh, God, I'm blocking my therapy. I'm a worm. And I'd come into the AA meeting. I'd say, I can't remember anything. I'm blocking my therapy. And they said, well, hell, don't worry about it. None of us can. I said, well, I'm blocking my therapy because I've been doing this for years. And they said, why do you think you're blocking your therapy? And I said, well, I'd go in on Thursdays, and I couldn't remember where we were on Tuesdays. And they said, hell, man, if you remember where his office is, you got your head of the game. Just find his damn office. And I got that in AA because you kept telling me that's the way we are. We're not going to sleep. We can't remember anything. All the other was simple problem solving and stress management. Screwed up for 6 months to 2 years. Those are living skills. Like, I wonder which one of these restrooms I'm supposed to go into, you know? Is that a skirt or is that a pair of pants? That's simple problem solving. But we're going to try to figure out who God is, right? Yeah. Oh, so what I used to do when I would just be going crazy is I remember when I was a little boy in Sunday school kindergarten in Western Kentucky, I'd rock in that little chair, and they'd say to me, God is love, God is love, God is love. And when I'd get tight, I'd just sit there and rock and say, God is love, God, and it would bring me some peace. I did that the same time I was calling my sponsor and trying to figure out how to get to the meeting, but it brought me peace because God is love. And if you don't believe it, just feel what we've been with tonight. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to feel. It takes a pseudo-rocket scientist like me to try to figure it out. You know? So that's the way I was for 10 years. I was all over Louisville, goofier than a goat. I found out that those people we got into treatment that came back, and fortunately I was in a group of people who were just as sick as me, and we stuck together and nobody else came around us, so we kept the sickness close and encapsulated. At least we weren't spreading it. And I noticed these people just didn't come and go with us anywhere. Finally, God left. I asked God one time, I said, God, why didn't you leave me out there for 10 years? Because I had a series of events that occurred at 10 years that brought me to my knees, just literally brought me to my knees. And I asked God, I said, God, why didn't you leave me out there for 10 years? If you could have done something about this, why didn't you leave me out there? And I felt his voice say to me, son, you may lead by your knowledge. You will heal with your experience. And I feel like one of the most privileged people on earth because God chose me to lay out there and be crazy for 10 years. And to be able then to come to you because I'm reasonably articulate and totally committed to this message and share it with you because some of you really desperately need to hear it. And I sure as hell need to be reminded of it, okay? What happened in that event, let me take you back to my childhood. Now, the big book says we go back through our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. Y'all know where that is? If you don't, then you need to go read your book. It's in the fifth chapter in the fourth step in going back and looking at our inventory. We go back through our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. And that's not psychobabble. I absolutely applaud someone who will go back and look at their early life. I need to warn you that if you use that as an excuse to justify your current behavior, you're not going to get sober. You may not take a drink, you just won't get sober. And I'll talk about the peculiar mental twist and where this plays a part in that for me later on. But in any event, Let me take you back to my life, to my home. I was born in a home where there was no alcohol and no drugs. My grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. They had an interesting way of treating alcoholics in the middle 30s in Mayfield, Kentucky. When my grandfather would get drunk, they'd put him in jail. When he'd sober up, they'd put him in a chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. And my mother used to walk past her daddy at least once a week, sweeping in the Mayfield City streets in a chain gang. This is a little town of 12,000. The scarlet letter of A on my mother's forehead was not for adultery, it was for alcoholism. She was not an alcoholic, she was a true adult child. And whether you believe in that concept or not, read the family affidavit where it says, Wilson used the word neurotic. If you're raised by us or live with us, in essence, you get neurotic. And my mama, who was one of the neatest people I've ever met, one of the gentlest, loving people I've ever known, my mother was goofy. And she was really goofy. What a lovely, I think my mama died in 1978, and I think of her almost every single day. I think of my mother because I really loved my mother. I loved her deeply, but my mother was a very wounded lady who never had an opportunity to look at this. And it dominated our home. It dominated our home because my mother lived, her whole alter ego was living through her boys. I'm the first Brady who ever went to college. And I asked my daddy, I said, Daddy, why did I become a doctor? There's never been any doctors in our family. He said, I'll tell you why. He said, when you were born, I walked into the hospital the day after you were born, your mama's holding you in her arms, and she said, Hal, that's my daddy, this one's going to be a doctor. My brother's 8 years younger than me, and said, when I walked in, said, your mama looked down and said, Hal, this one's going to be a lawyer. And he is a lawyer. He's also been in AA for 12 years, so it kind of cleans him up a little bit. I like him anyway. But he ain't real proud that I'm a doctor, so it's a 50-50 break, you know. And says the same thing. But in any event, my mother lived through her boys, through this is her alter ego. And I found out quickly, when I was perfect, Mama was happy and life was better. I mean, I found that out as a little child. And so I became perfect. And when I was perfect, Mama would dust off my little butt, part my little hair, fix my little clothes, pick up my little dirty clothes, and she raised an absolute monster. She really raised the king baby. Have y'all ever read T-Boat? And it came from Freud, but T-Boat was one of Wilson's great confidants, a psychiatrist in the early 40s, and he wrote a treatise called Compliance and Surrender. And there he talks about the king baby syndrome, which is what most of us drag into this program. That's what Wilson calls self-centeredness. But Mama raised a king baby. What I didn't really realize about that until for some years was it absolutely defined my relationship with women. And my relationship with women was a job description, which was all women are supposed to take care of me and make me feel special. Now, I didn't know that, but I dragged it right with me. And interestingly enough, you know, that ain't too big a deal if you're reasonably articulate, can slide a little snot down the thing and have a little bit of money, because if the holes in my head rocks in my head fit the holes in hers, I found women who would play that game. I didn't find any healthy ones who would, but I found some that would. Now, in the middle 70s, I was married to my first wife. We married in 1958, Libby's mother. And finally, I just drank enough whiskey that Sally kicked me out of the house. She was about as sick as me. She didn't have an alcohol or drug problem, but I guarantee you, with that kind of history that I told you about, she wasn't going to be too healthy or she wouldn't have stayed with me. So she stayed with me, and she really wasn't very healthy. End result was that in 1975, with drinking enough whiskey, she finally kicked me out of the house. I womanized for about 2 years and met Casey, who is my current wife. And those of you who've met Casey know what a wonderful, wonderful lady this woman is. Incredible. She's the first healthy woman ever came in my life. And we developed this incredibly beautiful, wonderful relationship. Now, all alcoholics take hostages. We sometimes call them spouses. We sometimes call them sponsors. We sometimes call them pigeons. But we take hostages. And you can define the recovery of someone by the fewer number of hostages they take. If live and let live doesn't mean anything to you, what it basically means is to quit taking hostages. And my wife was my number one hostage. I was a benevolent dictator. I was absolutely wonderful to this woman. She quit drinking when I quit drinking, went to Al-Anon for 6 years, then switched and went to AA. We went to open meetings together. I put her right here on my hip. We went to meetings together. We opened the morning with a meditation book out of the little meditation book because I wasn't reading the big book. I wanted her to have the finest clothes that I could afford, and I could afford some. And I bought them for her. I never asked her what kind she wanted. I just brought them home. I wanted her to have nice cars. I didn't ask her what kind of car she wanted. I just bought her a car. I wanted her to have nice vacations, and we went on nice vacations. Never asked her where she wanted to go. And that was a perfect life. I gave her everything I had. What I asked in return was every single thing done the way I wanted it done. And that was the way we lived. When Casey came into Alcoholics Anonymous, after about 2 years, she came to me and curled up on the couch. She said, Burns, she said, I've never loved you more, but I want to go back to college, want to start attending my own meetings, and want to go into therapy. What I heard was, you're leaving me. Now, that's not what she said, but that's what I heard. Now, what does this drunk do? Who hadn't had a drink now in 8 years, almost nine by this time. What did this drunk do when he thinks his caretaker's leaving? She was not living by the job description, was she? We find another one, don't we? Now, for doctors, who takes care of us and makes us feel special? Nurses. And I worked in a doctor's office where there were seven of us. We each had a little cubicle, and we had a nurse who took care of us. And this nurse had been working for me for 2 years. One of the neatest, truly class people that I've ever known. Neat lady. She was divorced. Not a single thing had happened. I never thought of anything happening. But within 6 months of the time Casey started back on her journey, Kathy assumed almost Virgin Mary proportions. She became perfect. This was the most wonderful woman I'd ever seen in my life. Now, I had a problem with this. I found I was in love with two women. I really loved my wife, and I really loved Kathy. So what I decided was, and I'm 51 years old by this time, I've been sober 10 years, and I'm sitting down absolutely trying to figure out how I can get the three of us together so we can talk about living together, because I don't see any reason why we can't, because I love them both. Why do you find that ridiculous? So I can see some of the guys sitting there, you know, they're not even smiling. They're like, well, what's the joke? What happened? You know, did you do it? You know, you just, like, how? Yeah. Well, my first sponsor, I went to, did a fifth step with him to tell him, and he'd been my sponsor for 10 years, to tell him this whole thing, and I did a fifth step because there was one boundary that no one, that I couldn't cross, and the book tells us we can't, and I'm sure you find out, and that's the boundary of honesty. You break the code of honesty, we don't stay sober. In fact, we almost invariably get drunk. At least that's been my experience. So I knew I was in real trouble, intellectually. I didn't feel like I was going to get drunk, but I knew I was in, it wasn't making sense even to me. So I went and talked to my first sponsor, told him this whole deal, and he called my wife and told her. Now, I run the Impaired Physicians Program for the state of Kentucky. The big thing I do that I love most of all is I also am the addictionologist or the addictionist for a 250 men and women's homeless shelter where we sleep 250 people a night. We have 150 of those people in a year-long program of recovery using Joe McQuaney's Recovery Dynamics. And for 6 months, all they do, this is the indigent homeless shelter. By the grace of God, we've got 500 of these people sober after 5 years. And they study the big book all day, and they go to meetings all night, and they have community during the day, 4 days a week. And when I do this class I do with them on rotating chapters 5, 6, and 7, 5, 6, and 7, 5, 6, and 7, I get to that point when we talk about resentment. I tell them this story. And I say, now what would y'all do?
Well, I'd shoot the son of a bitch. That's what I'd do.
And the reason I tell them this is because I want them to hear what is the normal reaction. And then I want to walk them through what I had to do to reach a spiritual conclusion that not only forgave this man, took responsibility for my behavior, and then went and asked him what I could do for him. That's what the drill is, isn't it? If you don't know where that is, read the fifth chapter, because it'll turn your life around. When you're sitting there at that crossroads and you're trying to figure out how you're wanting to go help somebody who's just told your wife that you're having an affair. You think you want to know when the rubber hits the road? By God, you'll find out when the rubber hits the road. Because I knew that if I didn't figure out how to do this, that was what it told me to do, that I was probably not going to stay sober. And it did turn my life around. You know how I got into that? Because I've told you I wasn't a student of the book, didn't even read it. I found that if the student's ready, the teacher will arrive. And I said, God, please help me. And this little pigeon of mine with 7 months sobriety came up and handed me these 8 tapes and said, listen to these tapes and tell me if they're any good. And they were Joe and Charlie's tapes of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I listened to those tapes, I cried all the way through them because I knew exactly the program I didn't have. I had 11 copies of those made, and 12 of us guys got together and started a Big Book study. All 11 of us are still sober. One died. He died sober. Our lives have changed dramatically. And from that movement and other movements similar to that, Michael brought in Joe and Charlie to come in and do their Big Book study. But before they ever came in, we were churning this throughout the community. And the whole presence of Alcoholics Anonymous changed in Louisville, Kentucky because of God coming that way into our lives and bringing us down into the simplicity of the program. When I came out here and talked, Scott, what was the... you had me out here to talk at what? Great Plains. When I came out here that night, I was when I was waiting to go up there to talk, back on the wall, it had Dr. Bob's last talk. It also was Bill's last talk. Now, those of you who are AA historians know that Bill was too sick really to give that talk. But in that, he had made 2 major points. One was that anonymity would ever have to be essential for recovery. The other point he made was that AA must and will change. And when I looked at that out here, that was when I first read that out here, and I thought, what does that mean? And when I got home, I called Geraldine Delaney in New Jersey. By that time, Miss Delaney had been sober almost 50 years. And I said, Miss D, has AA changed since you came in? She said, yes. I said, how's it changed? She said, when I came in, there were 5 or 6 old-timers for every newcomer. She said, today there are 50 or 60 newcomers for every old-timer. She said, we've got people with 1 and 2 and 3 years of sobriety sponsoring people. I said, is that bad? And she said, it's reality. I don't know if it's bad or good. The issue is, how are we going to deal with it? Because I've just told you where I was at 2 years, even 10 years, but certainly at 2 years in sobriety. And I couldn't find my car in the parking lot. At the same time, we've got guys with 6 months of sobriety in that homeless shelter who become the teachers of the book after 6 months by using Joe's outline on how to talk about the concepts in the book. I said, well, what are we going to do? And she said, what we have to figure out is how best to transmit the principles to the greatest number of people as rapidly as possible and as consistently as possible. I said, how are we going to do that? And she said, I'm not sure. And I'm sitting here thinking, what about Big Book studies? Bright idea. It's working in Louisville. Why not? And I'm absolutely convinced, based on my experience, this is what we're going to have to look at. Because the rest of this country is not as privileged, for one reason or another, to have what you people have got here as about as developed as any place I've ever been in this country. There's nothing like this in Louisville. I don't even know if it should be. I don't even know if it could be. What I do know is that what we are doing is we're having Big Book studies. I go to 5 meetings a week, and 2 of those are Big Book studies all the time. One of which I lead, another of which I participate in with someone else leading. In addition to giving those men in the homeless shelter, I don't do the women. We don't let men on the women's campus. We don't let women on the men's campus. And there's a real good reason for that. you know? And it's not just because of he-in and she-in. It has to do with role modeling. It has to do with role modeling. One of the principal ingredients in alcoholism that we know is one of the psychological components is a poor identification with a parent of the same sex. And every drunk I've ever worked with basically has a screwed up relationship with a parent of the same sex. It may be through death, it may be through divorce, it may be through drinking. It's just generally non-existent. And we don't know how to be what we turned out to be. I know I'm a man because I stand up to pee and I zip my pants in the front. I'm pretty sure I'm a man, right? But I swear to God, it was a tough time figuring out how to do man stuff. And role modeling through my sponsor, even my first sponsor, who was goofier than a goat, was God's great gift to me because he taught me so many things that just had to do with what do men do when men are supposed to do things that men are supposed to do. It's exactly what he didn't teach me shit about AA, except I did learn obedience, and I did stay teachable, and he was a great gift to me. Some of the stuff I learned from that man is don't do it that way, don't do it that way, but I learned it. I don't know where I got off on all that, but that's exactly right. I guess I needed to talk about it, I guess I need to talk. Now if I can figure out where I was, I'll go back and start all over again. Anyway, so the Big Book Studies. As I've studied this book, I found an interesting thing in here. This may be old hat to some of y'all. May be brand new to some of you, and I need to remember it, and I need to talk to y'all who maybe didn't know this. When I looked in this book, I found an interesting thing. I found that alcohol was not my problem. In fact, it even says alcohol is a symptom, and in another place, the bottle is a symbol. Now, for those of you who are an alcoholic of my type, let me be sure, because I know how your little minds are starting to think right now, You don't even know your little mind's thinking that way, but it is thinking that way. You're thinking, without even knowing it, well, if it's not my problem, then I bet you if I get this program right, I'll be able to drink again. You don't even know you're thinking that way, but I promise you, honest to God, that's exactly the way you're thinking. Well, I can sit here and I can write on this wall the formulas that says what Silkworth said about a physical allergy and mental obsession. That's what I'm trained to do. I spent the last 15 years studying this disease so I can teach doctors how to treat us and teach us not to practice medicine without a license. In any event, I can write that up there, and if you're an alcoholic my type, you'll never be able to drink like a normal person. You'll never be able to drink like a normal person. But if you're like me and you buy this program, then your problem's not alcohol. Now, it caused me a lot of problems, but it's not my problem. What did it tell me my problem was? My mind, the way I think. I've had people say from a podium, well, alcoholics think just like other people. No, we don't. I spent 25 years practicing family medicine. I had thousands of people walk through my office that aren't alcoholics. They cry when they get frightened. They bleed when they get cut. But when they're sitting at a red light and the horn goes off behind them, they don't go, ooh, to the person behind them. And we do it every single time. That's the alcoholic. Oh, yeah, and you can gauge your level of recovery if someone honks behind you and you look in the mirror before you give them the sign, because that means your judgment's coming back, because if it's a big man back there in an 18-wheel truck, you ain't going to give him the sign, are you? No. The first level of recovery is judgment return. Then if it gets further and your spirituality comes in, you absolutely don't even look in the mirror. Your chin goes on your chest and you pray that God forgive this miserable son of a bitch who's honking that horn back there now. And then you really make it where you really wonder if they've had a bad day and why are they so upset, and you hope to God that their day gets better. And their day gets better. No, we don't think like normal people. We overreact to everything. Every single thing in our life is a crisis. Worse than anything on God's earth. It's a crisis. You don't believe it? Ask Peggy how she felt before the Nebraska-Texas A&M game today. Or ask me how I felt before the Kentucky-Indiana basketball game today. I don't even watch Kentucky play on TV. I tape them, and if they win, I look at it. If they don't win, I don't look at it.
spent 4 months in psychiatric therapy 4 years ago trying to figure it out. One day I said, who in the hell cares? I'm just going to keep taping it, you know? But that's the way it is. That's the way we overreact to everything. And it's called the peculiar mental twist. The most devastating 6 inches in my whole world is the distance between my left ear and my right ear. It's the way I think. And Wilson called it a peculiar mental twist. And he says that's exactly what happens before every single drink. And when we come into AA, what do they tell us? If you stop the drinking and don't deal with the thinking, you go back to the drinking. Or they tell us, someone comes in on Monday to a meeting and says, that just had a relapse. And I'd say to Jim, my sponsor, so-and-so had a relapse Saturday night. And he'd say, no, they didn't. They took a drink Saturday night. They had a relapse 6 months ago. It's the way the drinking starts. It starts way back yonder. The peculiar mental twist. And I want to talk to you about the peculiar mental twist and its manifestations in this alcoholic. The way I think and the way the drink starts. I want to tell you a story. Now, if any of y'all have ever heard my tape, and most of you around here haven't heard me that much, so it'll be an original story for y'all. For those of you who have heard it, you'll hear it again. Because it's a great joke, and it's a typical alcoholic joke. I was down in East Texas and talking at a conference. There was a fellow down there named Damon. Damon had about 50 years of sobriety, and he talked like he had a flat brainwave. But if you listen to this guy, if you listen to this guy, I mean, he was funny. And I got right on that front row and listened to him because he was funny. And he was talking about this traveling salesman in East Texas who was, as we say in Western Kentucky, bad to drink. And he would travel all over each of these towns. He'd go to Beaumont and stay a week. All day he'd work. He'd go in that night, check in the motel, and then go out and get drunk, come back. And they'd set him up to keep his business with booze and that kind of stuff. And he'd stay there a week and go to the next town, Finally, he'd had all this fun he could tolerate, like a lot of us. He goes home, he gets in treatment, goes to aid, does something, but he gets straight. Comes back a month later, and he checks in the motel, and that night he goes out to go to an AA meeting. They think he's going out to get drunk. He comes back in, he switches on the light, opens the door, switches on the light, and they've got him set up like they always do to keep his business. There's a big fifth of whiskey and a big tub of ice beside the bed. And on the foot of the bed sitting these two beautiful women. He looked at them and he said, I've started going to AA and asking them what I had to do to stay sober and to be happy. And they told me I had to quit drinking and change everything I'm doing. He said, so I can't drink that whiskey. And one of you girls is going to have to leave. Now, let me tell you about that guy. I want you to follow this. This guy had it almost right, didn't he? He knew that he's supposed to have one woman at a time. But he hadn't yet read that segment of the fifth chapter on sex where it's supposed to be loving and sharing and spiritual and all of the things that make a relationship. But at least he's to the point where he's got it down to one at a time. Now, if he's going to do this 6 months later and he's already learned the difference, as many of us do, then he's going to think he's what? Bigger than the rules. The first part of the peculiar mental twist in Burns Brady is when I begin to think like I'm bigger than the rules. In any of my affairs, I've got 9 points on my driver's license. That means if I get 3 more points, I walk. I mean, you don't drive in Kentucky with 12 points. They take your driver's license. And when I get in 65-mile-an-hour speed zones, I drive 95. And I'm happy with it. It pisses the cops off. I mean, and they don't even want to negotiate. I say, well, I'm a doctor, and I'm late getting in the hospital. Don't give a shit. There's your ticket, you know. I mean, that's the way it is. You know, I'm going to give them the poor suffering alcoholic routine, and they don't want to hear it. So I don't even care. I don't even say anything. I just get my ticket. But I'm sitting at home the other night, and I thought, why do I have these 9 points? Am I stupid? No, I've got all these degrees. Say I'm not stupid. Well, do I have a mental illness? No, I've got 4 discharge summaries from psychiatric hospitals because I don't have a mental illness. So I finally concluded the only obvious thing. I'm Burns Brady. That gives me the right to go 95 miles an hour and 65 mile an hour speed. Handicapped parking places. If you start to stop, you know, get ready to stop in one, no, you can't do that. But if I'm going in the bank for 15 seconds, I can do it. Why? Because I'm Burns Brady. Now, you extrapolate that into how I begin my day. On the days that I open with the 11-step prayer, the 3rd-step prayer, the 7th-step prayer, and I spend 20, 15 minutes letting God's grace, God's power, and God's feeling come into my heart, this day is going to be a good day. If I absolutely react throughout the day with the 10th step, it's going to even be a better day. And if I close my day with the 11-step prayer, just the way it's written in the book, it is an incredible day. And that's so simple. Do I do it every day? No, and anybody in this room that tells me they do, you're lying. And why? Because I'm bigger than the rules. Year ago, Saturday morning, I'm absolutely laying in the bed. I'm so mad over something that happened on Friday. And Casey's getting ready to go to her meeting, and she pulls a chair over next to me, and she said, Burns, she said, I love you so much, I don't have time to sit here and dilly-dally around you. I just need to tell you how much I love you, and then tell you that I think you need to hear this. And I said, what, honey? She said, you've gotten bigger than the program. And I looked at her, and I thought, my God, how can she say this? I mean, you hooked yourself to my belt. You're on a spiritual rocket. Hell, I'm everywhere, all over Jefferson County, saving drunks, teaching drunks, saving doctors, putting medical. I mean, my God, how can she say this? I said, I understand, honey. She said, you haven't talked to your sponsor in 6 months. And I sat there and looked at her and knew she was dead right. Bigger than the rules. Every single day, you ask yourself, if you're a drunk like me, if you want to look at your peculiar mental twist, if you've learned the rules and you're not playing by them, why not? What Wilson called that? Self-centeredness. You know what the psychiatrists call us? Narcissistic. You know what my standing diagnosis is in every one of those mental hospitals in the 60s? Was psychopathological, narcissistic, sociopathic personality disorder. That means I've got the psychological profile of a serial killer. And you know their diagnosis was correct. They diagnosed exactly what they saw. And when we see that newcomer come in, watch him. He fits that psychological profile. We call it self-centeredness. Second part of the peculiar mental twist, victimization. You're my problem. By God, if you'd get your act together, I wouldn't be in this mess. Oh, see, I was born real poor, and I milked that for 40 years.
If you'd been poor like me, you would, you know, had to caddy rather than belong to that country club. Watch those little rich bastard dive in that swimming pool. Yeah, you'd have been a drunk too. Well, if you'd been poor like me, you'd have, and couldn't afford to go to college, you had to work your way through. If you'd been poor like me and couldn't buy a car, you had to walk everywhere you went. And if you'd been poor like me and had to marry that rich bitch and live with her for 17 years, I mean, the whole deal.
Oh, yeah, I had a heart attack in 1994, almost died. I mean, literally, shockers on my chest. It was ER all over again. I mean, ER is the best continued medical education course I've ever seen, including medical school. It's a wonderful program. All the shocks, the whole deal. And I mean, I was, for a year after that, oh my God, I'll never be whole again, you know. My heart's over, you know. Next will be my prostate. My bladder will blow out. Yeah. I'll never have another erection, not in this life. I mean, I mean, you could have written a movie on this thing. I mean, it just dripped. It just dripped, and still does in a heartbeat. Victimization. And what did Wilson, and victims don't get sober. They just may not all drink. There's a whole program that has been devised for people who get in a victim role. It's called Al-Anon. It's called Al-Anon. And people in Al-Anon will tell you that as long as they stay a victim, they lose absolute control and absolute ability to have a life of their own. And the AA program is the same. We just haven't focused on it. Live and let live. Let go and let God. It's the same deal to let us become free of our victimization. And what Wilson called victimization? Resentment and self-pity. You want a word synonymous with self-pity? Victimization. Look at me. Poor, pitiful me. because of them. And sometimes it is so close to, it can smell so right that it feels right. You know, my wife sleeping with the next door neighbor. Oh, my God, I'm hurting so damn bad. She's screwing the next door neighbor. What do you want from me? Well, for one thing, I don't know, but you keep that stance and you'll be drunk in about a month. What are you going to do with it? We got a program called the 12 Steps of the Big Book to deal with that. When my daddy died, I just nearly choked to death. Yes, it's real. But thank God there's a program here that God can lead me through so I can turn this over, let it go, and go on with my life. Third part of the peculiar mental twist is square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. If the square peg won't fit in the round hole, just beat the hell out of it. Just beat it and beat it and beat it till it fits. Now, why do I have to do that? I'll tell you, for me, it comes right out of the second half of the first step. Every single day, it comes out of the second half of the first step. Who's in charge of my life? Who is going to be in charge of my life? I will promise you there will be a number of people in this room who will drink again. That's just a statistical fact. And not a single one of you will drink again because you haven't dealt with the first half of the first step. You will drink because you haven't dealt with the second half of the first step. We have a way of evaluating alcoholics and making a diagnosis. One of them is called the MAST test. It has 25 questions. And each of those questions has an assigned value of points. And if you answer yes to a question, it may be 1 point. You answer yes, it may be 5 points. If you got 5 points total, then in all probability, you're an alcoholic. And one of those questions is, have you ever been to an AA meeting? If the answer is yes, that's 5 points. So there's not one single person in this room with a drinking problem that doesn't know that they are powerless over alcohol. Why do I get into a daily fight with the second half of the first step? And I'll tell you simply why I do. There are days, it's obvious to me, I just don't trust God. And you know why I don't trust God? Because I think God is going to come up with something for me that I just can't handle. And if I don't think I can handle it, then I'm going to have to try to control it to get it to come out the way I want it to come out so that I don't just get decimated by the fear of not being able to handle it. You know, this thing about God won't give us more than we can handle, that doesn't work for me. Let me tell you why. It works, but it doesn't work for me. What works for me is I will not have to deal with more today than we can handle. And let me tell you why that God won't give us more than we can handle doesn't work for me. 1 year sober. I come running in on Tuesday night to my meeting. I come bouncing in and sit down next to my sponsor. 1 minute to eight. He said, where you been? I said, oh, God thinks more of my ability than I do because I had to get up at 5 o'clock and get to the hospital to see a patient. I had 7 o'clock. I had to be at another hospital for a staff meeting. At 8 o'clock, I had to be at another hospital for some other meeting. At 9 o'clock, I got to the office. I saw 60 people today. Had to rush back to a staff meeting at another hospital and just barely got here. I said, so God must think I can do more than I can do. He looked at me and said, would you bring me your appointment book next week? I said, why? He said, because I've just never seen God's handwriting, and I just can't wait to see it. And I can sit here with this peculiar mental twist and delude myself into believing that was God's message for me to do it when I set up the whole damn deal. And especially if you haven't talked to your sponsor in 6 months, it gets real shaky, doesn't it? This spiritual giant hadn't talked to his sponsor and was everywhere. Unfortunately, at the end of the day, I was really angry because they didn't understand exactly how it was supposed to be done, all the way from the president of the Jefferson County Medical Society to every damn pigeon I had. And if that sounds familiar, you're in a world of hurt, you know? You're in a world of hurt. So what do we got here? We got bigger than the rule, self-centeredness, victimization, resentment, and self-pity, and fear exhibiting control. And our book is well defined and well outlined on how to deal with every one of those, isn't it? It doesn't take a rocket scientist. It doesn't take a rocket scientist. But how difficult it is. How difficult it is if I try to do it alone. It's virtually impossible. The only answer I found, at least for this drunk, is spiritual. It's spiritual. And I need to address something about what I've come to see in Alcoholics Anonymous, is there are too many people that I have to work with that have made spirituality smoke, mirrors, and magic. There's a wonderful paragraph in the chapter, The Family Afterward, where it says, we must be rid of childish spirituality. God wants us to have our head in the clouds with Him. We must keep our feet firmly planted on the ground. That's where our fellow travelers are, and that's where our work is to be done. I've watched more people get screwed up by using the third step as a place to stop rather than a place to start than I can shake a stick at. I've seen more people get screwed up by going to page 449 in the third edition of the Big Book and saying, you just have to accept. Acceptance, serenity, are wonderful byproducts of a process. They are lousy goals. And when I see somebody sitting to me and say, well, you know what, yeah, he came through last night, he raped your cattle, he rustled your wife, he stole your children, he mowed your yard. Yeah, that was right out of Blazing Saddles, if you ever saw Blazing Saddles. Remember when he said that? He raped your wife, he rustled your cattle, he stole your children, he mowed your yard with somebody else's lawnmower, and he burned down all your buildings and shot all your chickens. What do I do? You just have to accept. Well, give me a friggin' break. Of course you don't have to accept. There's a process for acceptance. You know, you got to quit drinking. I know it, God. I'm trying to quit drinking. You got to accept. I'm trying to accept. Smoke, mirrors, and magic. The process is the process. And the results are acceptance and serenity. That's not just for me. It's not smoke, mirrors, and magic. It's a mystery. And the mystery is I just haven't seen the whole thing close. But I've seen parts of it. I've seen my grandchild. I don't know what she'll be, and I won't be here to see her grow up. There's a good probability I will not be here, certainly, to see her be that old. But I have every belief that in this mystery, if both her parents stay clean and sober and stay a part of this fellowship and this child sees it, I think you can bet, you can take it to the bank. This child will be an alcoholic. You can take it to the bank. The chances are 97% that child will be an alcoholic. Those are the statistics. But as my son said when he came in 13 years ago, Daddy, thank you for teaching me what I was going to be. Please help me. Because I'm what you said I would probably be. It's a mystery. This spirituality for me, and when my time's getting short, so I want to leave Omaha with the Burns Brady diagram of spirituality. It's a triangle. It's sitting on its point. And that point is on a base. And this corner is sponsor. This corner is meetings. This corner is the Big Book. And it's sitting on a base of honesty and one day at a time. You want balance in your life? If you're getting screwed up and you're really out of sorts and you know you're not where you need to be, put the diagram down. Have I talked to my sponsor? Have I started missing my meetings? Do I need to increase my meetings? Am I doing my 11th step, 3rd step, and 7th step, following the 12 steps in my life on a daily basis? Am I being honest? Am I staying in the day? I've had 3 sponsors. My God, they're as different as daylight and dark. I would never, ever live without one. I spend at least one day a week having breakfast with my sponsor. They came in the program same time I did. I go to the meetings I've talked to you about. The Big Book, let me tell you, there's some people in this country who think you can't do a 4-step for at least a year because of the post-acute recovery syndrome. Let me tell you what my experience is. We put those men in that non-medical detox. They literally, some of them are coming right out of prison. I mean, these people are so sick you can't imagine. And we put them through non-medical detox. 85% of people won't need medical detox. 15% will, and so don't try to practice medicine. Get to a doctor who knows this disease and they can decide. and they come across the street. Some of them really literally can't zip their pants. We stick a big book in their hand, and within 2 weeks, they are studying the big book. I've never seen anybody yet get screwed up by taking a fourth step too soon. I've seen a lot of people get screwed up by taking one too late. And it won't be your last one. And those people who came out of the 60s sometime, not all of them, but some of them who came out of the 60s will say, you only do the first 9 steps one time, and then you do the last 3 steps for maintenance. May work for them, doesn't work for me. Doesn't work for me. Okay? So I'm telling you, the big book right off the bat. Yeah, you may not think you're remembering it, but state-conditioned learning will allow you to remember it, whether you know it or not. And if that's preaching and teaching, stay with me, because this is one area where I know what I'm talking about. Honesty. Let me tell you, when I went to treatment, I was drinking a quart of whiskey a night, and I walked into that place and begged to go into treatment. Sitting in front of the guy running the treatment center, he looked at me and he said, Burns, how much do you drink? And I said, I drink a 6-pack of beer every night. And he said, you're lying. And I said, I know what I do it all the time. Why not I do that? I'd play golf the summer before I went to treatment, hit my ball on the green, go up and put a dime in front of my ball, come back and put my ball in front of the dime. Just saved myself a fourth of an inch on a 40-foot putt, and I hated my guts, and I did it time after time. Came back from treatment, and I hit that ball on the green, go over and put my dime behind that ball, put that ball back in front of that dime, and I'd walk off that green feeling good about me. I maybe couldn't find my golf cart, but I felt real good about me, you know? Hell, I might get in the wrong golf cart, but I felt pretty good about me. Cash register honesty, we sometimes get real esoteric in our meetings and say, you know, that's cash register honesty. We have to be honest with ourselves. With a peculiar mental twist, it's tough to be honest with ourselves without a sponsor and a support group. But I'll tell you what, I know every single time I'm lying. Every single time. And let me tell you, it just takes a little inch out of my soul. And enough of those inches add up to where the soul can believe it doesn't need the truth. It doesn't need the truth. Don't ever minimize cash restaurants. One day at a time, every fantasy, every projection comes out of a combination of not staying in the day coupled with the second half of the first step and its non-resolution. Buy this tape and take that home and think about it. Every fantasy, every projection comes out of not staying in the day coupled with who's going to run my life. And they gut me. They gut me. I mean, tell you, I finally, at long last, have a little bit of money in the stock market. And my wife just gets tickled because I'm getting better. But she says, you used to never go down and get the newspaper. Now you're down there as soon as it gets light enough so you don't trip over the chickens or whatever it is going down. And you come back. And I know when I come in to fix breakfast if the stock market did well the day before. Because you're happy. If it did bad, you're sad. Now, that hasn't been this year. But I've learned it to stay in the day. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Now, I'm going to close. I didn't have a chance to walk you through all my drunkalogue. I will tell you that the message from my drunkalogue is I took amphetamine for 12 years with no alcohol, alcohol for 8 years with no amphetamine. What my story tells and what I need to share with you is that an alcoholic of my type cannot process any mood-altering medication like a normal person. I am living proof I could not. Had my heart attack in 94. They gave me, I almost died. They gave me IV Ativan for 8 days. That's turbo Valium. And I knew what was going to happen, so I brought in an addiction specialist to take care of me. Because the doctor, when I told him I want to have the addiction specialist see me, he said, why? And I said, this is going to screw me up. He said, then I won't give it to you. And I said, would you give it to anybody else? And he said, yeah. And I said, then you give it to me. I said, you saved my life. He's going to come in and help save my soul and my sobriety. And I had to be transferred from that hospital out to the mental hospital and went through a 7-day bone-rattling detox from benzodiazepine, Valium, Ativan. I mean 7 days of pacing like a tiger. 17 years of sobriety. I wouldn't have given you 2 hoots in hell for every benzodiazepine that had ever been made. We are duck soup for alcoholics of my type, for any mood-altering medicine. That doesn't mean if you need it, you shouldn't take it. With 1 year of sobriety, I had a vasectomy. And when I had the vasectomy, I thought, boy, I'm not going to take any mood-altering medicine. I'm not going to let them put me to sleep. So I had it under local. And I won't tell you about 2 seconds into that procedure, I thought, my God, I've made a grave error in judgment this time. I I mean, I developed a thing called, if there's any doctors in the room, I developed a thing called vasovagal collapse by pulling that little muscle called the cremasteric reflex. When a man gets hit in the testicles, they pull up inside him, and that's called a cremasteric reflex. That's the old way of protecting themselves when they used to fight, when they were back in the dark ages, whenever that was. And so they pulled on that to do the vasectomy, and I had a cremasteric reflex for 3 days, and every time it pulled back, I'd faint. I mean, I faint. I couldn't get up off the bed without fainting, so my wife would bring in a number 10 fruit jar, and I'd pee in the fruit jar. For 3 days, I couldn't get up to pee. And so after 3 days, this is over, and I call my sponsor, and I am just tickled to death. I said, Jim, I had this vasectomy. I had it under local. I had vasovagal collapse. I couldn't pee anything but a fruit jar for 3 days, but I didn't take any mood-altering medicine. He said, you're an idiot. Message, ask for help, get doctors involved who know, have your sponsor go with you to talk to the doctor, and take what you need to take, given by someone who knows what they're doing. In closing, I'll tell you about my family. Both my children are straight. Short version is, they say the most significant person in their life was their daddy drinking. Most significant person in their life was their daddy sober. My mama died in 1978 of metastatic cancer. I had 8 months of sobriety to drive down with Casey every weekend, hug my mother, talk to my mother, make my amends. She hugged me. We were just never that far apart. And she died peacefully, and she died knowing that I was safe and that I was sober. My daddy is kind of like most of the Brady men that I've described to you. Up until me, we really didn't know how to take care of ourselves unless there was a woman taking care of us. And so my mother had been dead about a year, and Daddy remarried to a friend of the family, one of God's great gifts to us. Now, I need to tell you about my daddy. My daddy is one of the neatest people I've ever met. He wouldn't hug. He didn't say I loved you, but he was just always there. I mean, he was just always there. I broke my leg playing football. I broke it playing baseball. Daddy was right there. The first one to put me on a stretcher, Daddy was always there. No matter what kind of trouble I was in, Daddy was there. Never said a word. He just would appear. And I would go down and try to make my amends to my daddy after mother died, and Daddy wouldn't talk to me. He'd say, Burns Mac, I don't want to talk about it. It's okay. There were some things that happened in my daddy's life when he was growing up that really had him jarred and scarred about alcoholics, and I can't tell you about that. But I desperately wanted my daddy to tell me it was okay, and I've done at least 50 or 60 fifth steps of those men in that homeless shelter, and what I found out is every one of those men desperately wanted some significant male to say, it's okay. Now, there'll be a day when that isn't necessary, but I'll tell you, it still feels good. And that's what I wanted from my daddy, and he couldn't do that. I'd go down there and try to make my amends, and he'd say, go home, and I'd go home, and I'd tell my sponsor, to quit trying to shove it down your daddy's throat. Just show him you're sober. Daddy then began to lose his mind. It's a combination of Alzheimer's, senile dementia, whatever you want to call it. Clinically, the same way, he forgot who I was, forgot who my brother was, forgot that mother had ever been alive. Peggy and I put him in a nursing home. That's where he needed to be. For his benefit, that's where he needed to be. Pretty much every weekend, at least three times a month, I would drive 250 miles down to Western Kentucky, where I was born and raised. I live in Louisville. And I'd pull up in that parking lot. This was after I'd been sober about 12 or 13 years. And remember, now I want you to remember, I want you to remember that this was when a lot of miracles were happening in my life. And I'd pull up in that parking lot and I'd say, God, take away my pain. I'd go in there and it wouldn't work. I drove down this one Sunday and parked my car and I said, God, let me for my daddy what you want me to be. I walked in, Dad's in a wheelchair. I didn't call him daddy because that confused him. He thought I was Buster, his brother. And I said, Hal, how are you? And he said, fine, Buster. And I said, can I help you? And he said, yeah, would you shave me? I said, sure. And I shaved daddy. I said, would you like to go out and have some lunch? He said, believe I would, Buster. And I rolled him out there and fed Daddy. He was too weak to feed himself. And then Peggy came in and sat down. Peggy and I got to talking, and Daddy was watching because he used to like to watch Mother and me talk. Mother and I would get in these long conversations. Daddy would just sit there. He never said, he just watches. He loved to watch Mother and me talk. So I turned around and looked at him. I said, would you like to go out on the porch? And he said, I believe I would, Buster. And I rolled him out there, and Peggy and I got to talking. He's watching. He's raised up in his wheelchair, and he looked right at me. He said, son, today you just like the little boy your mother and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. 2 seconds later, or 10 seconds later, he didn't know who I was, and we buried him about 3 years ago, and he never knew me again. the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for those of you who've been in recovery long enough know this. Those of you who haven't, let me tell you, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that my daddy recognized me, was it? The miracle was that I said, "Dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be." I would be negligent, and I'd almost forgotten I need to do it. My wife and I were celibate for 4 years. After that event occurred in 10 years of sobriety, I did the right thing. But I'd put a scar in this almost incredibly unscarred relationship that had started in 1976. For 4 years, we were celibate. Finally, at 14 or 15 years of sobriety, Casey and I sat down and said, "We really need to get help." She was working a real good, solid 12-step program, and so was I. But the communication had been torn up, and the scars, we didn't know how to deal with this. We went into therapy and spent almost 3 years in therapy, and I will tell you what my program did for me. It kept my little ass on the chair when I wanted to get up and run. I'd get to the door, and I'm thinking, "I don't need this," as they would start to get too close to me, and I think, "We do not retaliate, we do not argue. Our problems are own making, the bottle's only a symbol." You know the drill. It's right out of the fifth chapter, and I'd sit down. I can tell you, for the last 3 years of our marriage, it has been an incredible relationship. It's everything the promises could ever imagine and more, because we worked our 12-step programs and then got help when we needed help. In this season of caring and sharing, in this season of saying, "Dear God, let me be for someone what you want me to be," in this season where we say, "God can give us everything we need if we just keep an open heart and are receptive," we of Alcoholics Anonymous do it 365 days a year, one day at a time. We don't have to have a season. This is just when we get to do it with Santa Claus suits and lots of nice lights and lots of good songs. But for us, we got it all year long. What a joy to be with y'all. Thanks for letting me come along.